outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey. The God Journey. The God Journey.
Well, hi, I'm Wayne Jacobson. Welcome back to The God Journey. We've got a special guest again today. I've got to probably make some things kind of clear because this could be confusing. Dave Coleman, who was with us about a month ago, we talked about what it means to love one another. And then last week I had David Rice on from Ireland. So this is, I'm going back now a month. We're inviting Dave Coleman back. We talked about a chart that he had worked out and some things about learning to love and not being threatened and let that lead to anger and fear or depression. We had a lot of you ask some questions, make some comments. And so we thought we'd have Dave back and see what we could process out here. So Dave, welcome back to the God Journey.
Well, thank you, Wayne. It's good to be back.
How are you doing?
Oh, fairly well.
Yeah, you guys have had some challenges of late. So that's been a little longer to get you back than we'd hoped, but glad you could join us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah. When someone asked this, I thought I'd throw it at you. This is an email to me. It says, Dave Coleman taking applications for 43-year-old granddaughters? I want one if he is. Great podcast. Wishing we had such spiritual leadership as you and Dave and the older men in my family. Thankfully, you stepped in many times for my dad through the years. That podcast gave me a lot to chew on. So you taking applications, Dave, for granddaughters?
Oh, you betcha.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's really special, and thank you for that.
Yeah, I think people really enjoyed the conversation. And some of us, I had one inner pushback, both on the blog and to me personally. It was kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say offended is the right word, but concerned that depression could be seen as a outgrowth of our being threatened in fear and anger, and kind of putting all depression into that category. You wouldn't do that, would you?
No, and I think when we did the first broadcast, I mentioned that there are a lot of, you know, pathological problems that can be caused, or even caused by medication and so forth. The thing that I was really thinking about at the time, well, may I give you an example from the days of my hospice chaplaincy?
Sure.
I once received a call to come out and visit a pastor who was dying. And unfortunately, the pastor belonged to a church where they were religious and knew nothing of grace. It was just, you know, you're going to get to heaven if you're a good person type of theology. And what happened was that when I went out there, I talked to the wife, and she said, you know, chaplain, he doesn't want to talk to you. And I said, well, why is that? And if you don't mind my asking, well, he's really depressed. And I said, really? I said, do you know why he's depressed? Well, she said, he's not really depressed, but he's angry. I said, well, may I ask why? Well, he's worked hard in the church, and he's been faithful to God and all these things. And now he just retired recently, a couple of months ago, and he's dying. And he's just mad at God because he thought that when he retired, he'd have another 20, 30 years where he could simply go camping, go visiting, go seeing the world, travel, and so forth. And he's just totally mad. And this is what I'm talking about, where people have expectations on God, and God doesn't meet those expectations, and then they get angry. And to me, it comes from just a misunderstanding of who God is and what God is all about. So that's the kind of depression I'm talking about, one that is a masquerade for anger.
Yeah, and I think we tried to make that clear through the chart, but I think some people got the impression we were saying all depression stems from that. So I'm really glad you drawn the distinction, because depression can be an incredibly debilitating thing, not rising from this at all. Like you said, could be coming from some kind of physiological reason or some other kind of thing going on in their emotions or their thinking. And so I certainly didn't want people to feel like, gosh, I'm suffering depression, so I must be angry about something, and I've got to fix this thing with God. And We're not trying to work back that way. Not all depression is caused by this process, but some depression is, the kind of depression that comes out of that anger and disappointment that God hasn't met my expectations. And,
right.
And there's a lot of that, isn't there? I mean, you told me at one point back, this was years ago, I don't know if you'd still go by the statistic, but you said when you were pastoring, you were a Lutheran pastor long time ago, man, 30 years or more, 40. You said you thought 90% of Christians lived with a resident anger towards God because he had disappointed something they wanted from him. Is that sound familiar?
Yes, it certainly does, and I still believe that. You know, when we really begin to think about the whole concept of God, when he created us in his image. Well, what does that mean? Well, like he said, you know, who are you, God? Well, I am who I am, which means I am a self-determining creation. I can decide to do this or I can decide not to do this. And if we are created in his image, then we can make decisions. And as I look at the whole concept of what is sin, sin to me is what I would call control. It's when Satan comes in and he says, hey, think of yourself. You don't need to trust God. You can do it yourself. In fact, you can get God on your side to do what you think needs to be done. And once we get into this kind of a mindset, then what happens is we put expectations on God. Then I begin to control God. And to me, the word sin simply means control.
Wow.
And from that point of view, because once you do not acknowledge who God is, that he's in control, and by that I mean the whole concept of our relationship with God is based on trust. And when Jesus came to demonstrate who the Father is, he said over and over again, you can trust Father. This is who he is. He takes care of you. He provides you. He loves you. He shows you how to live and so forth. In fact, when we look at what is the Bible is God's warning of people who will demonstrate who he is and what he is about. In short, that he has ideas that work if we understand our relationship with him, and not trying to live in the religious idea of, hey, I've done this, so I ought to get that. God, if you get me out of this hospital room and out of this surgery, through the surgery, I'll go to church 8,433 Sundays in a row.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and it's so hard to get people to understand that, hey, God really loves you, and what goes on in your life is something that he is using to transform you into the image of Jesus, so that people, well, when they see you as they saw Jesus, as he said to Philip, they will see something of what God is like. Because if we don't have that, then our life will consist of basically three things. I have two friends who are family counselors, and I'd say, what do you guys do? And they said, well, mainly we work on three things when we talk to people with problems. Number one, we have to get them not to run away from their problems, to see their involvement in the problems. Secondly, you can't hide from your problems. You can't make excuses for yourself. And the third thing is that you cannot shift blame. You cannot make yourself into a victim. And when you look at what happened in the garden with Adam and Eve, that's exactly what they did. They made excuses. Well, I didn't do it. She told me to do it. They hid themselves, and consequently, they lived out their lives in shame.
So I'm going to go back a little bit. Can you talk about Satan putting this idea of control in our hearts, that we should be able to get God to do what we think is best? And I think it's not just Satan. I mean, Satan does that definitely, but doesn't also our religious presentation of the gospel often do that? We present the gospel as if God's here to bless you, make every situation rosy, wonderful, good. I mean, we do that every Sunday in many of our religious environments, where we create those same expectations in people as promises. And then we talk about how God wants to answer our prayers and what you need to do to get God to answer. And a lot of that stuff, isn't it feed right into the same thing you're talking about? It's we use our faith to control God rather than come to faith by letting God work in us out his will.
Very true. Very true.
And when you talk about the cause or that need to control God, and then I think we best see that, because I don't think a lot of people run around saying, I'm trying to control God. But I think you recognize it in your life when you have disappointed expectations, when my expectations aren't happening in the circumstances I'm in. And you said that God's using all of those things to help us be more like him, to keep transforming us into his image, which isn't to say God causes all those things, right? God's not the author of suffering in our life. He didn't put horrible things there because he wants you to be a better person. And I get that email all the time. You know, I don't care about being a better person. I just want to be out of this thing. And the idea that God is the one who authors our suffering. You and Don are going through some medical stuff now, just aging and those kinds of things. You don't look at God as the cause of those things, do you?
No, we certainly don't. And it's sometimes, you know, it's difficult. And I think everyone who's ever gone through some of these things would agree that it's just hard to, you know, give thanks for all of these things. When you think of it, you're not thankful for cancer, or you're not thankful for the problems that we all undergo. But these are opportunities to really grow and to really understand who we are and what God is doing in and through these things. Somehow we don't really understand what the Apostle Paul said when he said, for me to live is Christ. It is no longer I, but Christ who now lives his life in and through me. And we live in a world, in a society of what we call rugged individualism. It's all about me and what you can do for me and how you can give me free things and how you can make my life more easy. Instead of saying, no, I'm here to demonstrate, as did Jesus, who the Father is.
It seems to be that we've even things about reading the Bible or praying or all those things is back to trying to manipulate God for the outcome we want, or the expectation that if God loves me, my life wouldn't have suffering in it, or the fact that my life did have horrible suffering in the past proves God doesn't love me. And I think we've lost this ability to say the world is a chaotic, broken place, and there's pain and hurt, and we all face it in different ways, some in greater degree than others. I'll absolutely admit that, and I haven't figured all that out, but God wants to invade that with us, walk us through what's been trying to damage us. And then, as Romans 8 says, he causes all things to work together for good. It doesn't mean that he causes all things. He's not the one who's causing the pain in my life. He's just the one who wants to be in my life with me, helping me through the pain. Sometimes, yes, healing. Sometimes transforming us in the midst of the thing. And when you use faith, or the word trust, which I like better, our growing trust in God allows us to wake up and say, God, what are you doing today? Instead of waking up going, okay, God, I need you to do this, and I need you to do that, and I need you to do that. And all the frustration of trying to get God to do something we think is in our best interest, but God has another plan. And we can't always see that plan, but we can wake up and follow him, however he's leading through those things, instead of just trying to get him to fix them.
That's right. And, you know, instead of trying to manipulate God by saying, if you really love me, God, you will do this or you will both do that.
Okay, one of the other things we mentioned going through that was you mentioned this study about religious children being worse than people not raised in religion. It was almost in passing, but somebody kind of said on the blog, hey, where is that study? What is that study? And you put a link there, which not everybody maybe have looked at on the past. I'll put the same link on this podcast as well. I went back and put it on that one. It's the negative association between religiousness and children's altruism across the world. And this was a fairly significant study of people schooled in religion, whether that's Christianity or Islam or Judaism. And then it went through, you know, how kind and gracious are they to people who are different than them. That's kind of what it got to, their altruistic feel. And it says, just to quote a little bit from the study here, it said, regardless of religious identification, frequency of religious practice, household spirituality, and overall religiousness were inversely predictive of a child's altruism, which meant the more religious they were, the less kind and gracious they were. Man, wow. That's a shock.
It certainly is. And I just reading one fellow wrote, it's just good how he said, you know, this is was kind of a shock to me, but yet I can see it in my own family, having grown up in the church.
Well, what's strange is we think we're being raised. I know I was raised in that environment, and you think we're being raised to be more loving, more kind, and more gracious. But the fact is we're kind of taught only to apply that to the home team. If you believe what I believe and you go to the church I go to and you're trying to live the same ethics I'm trying to live, then there's a love and kindness to each other that way. But anyone you think's not on the home team and they're not doing what you think they ought to be doing, it does lead to that judgment. I think in part because one of the things we try to instill in our children is a contempt for sin because we don't want them to sin. But that contempt actually translates to sinners too. So outside of the little club that we're in where we all supposedly love each other, even though there's a lot of gossip, backbiting, and all that in that environment, but beyond it, there isn't much love that flows to the world because there's a lot of judgment. I know for me, I saw sin when I was a kid growing up as the fun stuff God won't let us do. And that makes you resentful of people who are doing those things. And you're not going to, and you kind of, well, they'll get there someday. So you kind of, because of the fear of hell, you kind of stay doing the right stuff, even though you don't want to. And it's taken years for me to learn that sin is not the fun stuff God doesn't want us to do. Sin is the stuff that destroys us and keeps us from him, because it puts us all in our own head and our own preferences and our own self-indulgency. And it makes us, it destroys us. It destroys relationships. And God's inviting us out of sin, not because it's just the rules, but because he wants us to know the fullness of his life and what it is to be all that he created us to be.
In thinking the way you were saying about, you know, doing good stuff, I can't do it, I can't do fun stuff, it results in shame. Because we're going to do this. We're going to go out and sneak the cigarette behind the barn, or we're going to, you know, get involved. Don't smoke or chew or run around with those who do.
And well, that's an old phrase, Dave. That's an old one.
Yeah, I know it is. But what happens is we do those things and we end up with a lot of shame. And consequently, then, one of the motivations that takes place in church is you ought to be ashamed of yourself if you call you're a Christian. You know, it's this kind of thing that just, to me, destroys people. And causes this kind of anger.
And I think the way we compensate for shame, too, if we are, and we are, no one's growing up sinless, right? So even if we know the rules, there's things we let into our heart and our heads, and we do things that we regret, and we confess them to God, and we feel that shame. And one of the compensations for shame is, I got to make myself feel better than you. So I'm going to highlight whatever good I've done to make me feel better than you, which still argues against this altruistic kindness, graciousness toward outsiders, toward people who are not part of the club, who are not as trying as hard as I am. And I love that the only way to resolve that is to come to Jesus and let him take our shame and realize we were never meant to perform. This was not about performance. This was about letting him transform us from the inside out.
And to understand basically what we have when we are in Christ.
And we haven't focused on that enough. I think the religious environments are so built on this desire for conformity and everything looks good on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the inside, we know we're nowhere a failure. We know we can't live up to the things we're even pretending to live up to. And that creates all kinds of stuff inside. Like you said, we feel angry, we feel threatened, and then we're headed down those roads of either being abusive toward others or sometimes slipping into that kind of depression that's so paralyzing to our lives. Someone suggested, talked about God's glory a little bit, asked you to define it more. Do you remember that little exchange?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the glory of God is just God's definition of himself, that he is, you know, the whole idea of the Bible is God wanting a people, as I mentioned, who will demonstrate who he is. And all through the Bible, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, where it's pointed out that you are a people that are holy to the Lord. The Lord your God has chosen you. He loves you. Not that you are bigger or any other reason, but because he set his love upon you and chose you. And to me, the church then, if they could just grasp this whole idea of we have a God who loves us, God who saves us, protects us, provides for us. If we could just get that across and not worry about this whole idea of, no, we have to prove that we're worthy of God, to me would go a long way in just allowing the church to be the church. You know, it, as I mentioned last time, it grieves me to see all the churches closing. And you ask your question, the question, why are churches closing? And to me, it's what you pointed out before. And, you know, we have to look good, sound good, be good. And instead of saying, hey, God loves you, and that's it. And all I want you to do is to just demonstrate this unconditional love, this respect, and this I'm safe idea, instead of God is out to get you if you don't. It's just a, you know, a basic thing. And if we could get that across instead of, you know, all this other stuff that you and I went through as children, I think it would be a long way to keep the church alive or well.
Yeah, and I grew up in more of a charismatic tradition than I think you did. And we seem to, as I hear you talk about God's glory, just being the essence of his character, the essence of who he is, and reflecting that in our lives, I think we were more taught about this Shekinah glory of stuff that glows and God's presence that's overwhelming. And as I hear you talk about it, I'm going, you know what? I think a lot of my growing up, we depersonalized God's glory. We made it a separate thing that we like wanted to experience, and God's glory meant that, you know, wonderful things happened for us. I don't think we thought about it as his character, his life taking shape in us. So as we treated other people in the world, we could demonstrate a bit of who he is by not by just sinlessness, not by trying not to do the bad stuff, but by the way we actually, you know, the whole fruits of the Spirit, kindness, love, peace, joy, just the way we would treat other people and that concern, and there are concern about them, that's God's glory demonstrating itself in the world. And we were doing a lot of praying that God's glory would fall down on our worship service, you know, and people would glow in the dark and people would vibrate with excitement. And we were saying God's glory is a wholly depersonalized event, rather than God making himself known and then God transforming us so that we could demonstrate who he is in the world by the way we love and treat people. Yeah. I had some people here this weekend. We're kind of putting the finishing touches to a book we've been working on called The Language of Healing, which kind of harkens back to some of my bridge builder days. And we were constantly talking about the kinds of quotes that we were reading, even about people who are talking about how evangelicalism today expresses something so different in the world, fear and anger, and it doesn't make an open space for people who disagree with us. Instead, it seems to make, we're right, you're wrong, you need to conform to our ways, and it goes right to what you're talking about. How does that put God's glory in the world?
There was one other question about, someone asked about forgiveness with the whole concept of unconditional love.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, but that was my ad. I mean, let me just be honest about that. When Dave's chart to me just had under love unconditional, and I changed it to forgiveness, because as I talked about it with you, it was about that God treats us as if, you know, sin's not an issue between us because he loves us and gets past that. You call that unconditional love. Unconditional love is not a term I use. I hate that term. And the reason I hate it is simply because I don't think there's anything that exists called conditional love. If you have conditions on your love, it's not love. And so I tweaked that word on your chart. So I don't want people hanging that around your neck. You had unconditional there, which is what his comment was about how do we get back to it? It's not just God forgives us, we're these pitiful, horrible creatures, and God manages to forgive us if we ask enough for forgiveness. And I agree with that. That's not what I meant by that.
What I was thinking about is, you know, how do we love our neighbor by showing them love and respect and making them feel safe? The thing that is so, that I have found so often in the lives of people is that they cannot forgive God and they cannot forgive others. So then they're unable to meet people on a basis of simply honest and open love without having a hook in it. What I meant here by this is that we have to experience this ourselves before we can share it with others. Because if not, then we become Pharisees, and then the whole concept of we don't get this, and then we go down the hill again. That's all I was going to mention on that.
Yeah, and that's where we have to find it in Him, right? I mean, we try. I think in our brokenness and humanity, we try to find love and security in another person, and we may find somebody who really loves us, and for a season, they're able to do that. And at some point, I guess just like we get disappointed with God sometimes, not doing things the way we want, we'll get disappointed in someone else not providing what we want. And that kind of starts us down that whole being threatened and angry and all that road again.
That's right.
And I think until we really do, and this is so important in the whole process of helping people learn to live loved, is that until I get that love from Him, until I know what love is, not because we loved Him even, but because He first loved us. That first love is all about, wow, how deeply loved I am by Him, how secure I am in His love for me. But I think, again, go back to expectations. A lot of people say, well, I want to be secure in God's love, but God doesn't keep all this bad stuff from happening to me. And, you know, I've got medical issues, or I've got, work issues or financial issues, and I'm praying and I'm asking God to change them, and He's not changing them. And then people lose any sense of security in God's love because of the disappointing outcomes in their life. And I what I want to say to people, and I've often said, is don't you want God's love most when you feel most at risk? That's where God becomes a refuge. God's not really a refuge if everything in your life is awesome. God's the refuge I crawl into when I get the medical diagnosis that, oh, crud, I wish I didn't get that. And like I had open heart surgery a couple years ago. I would love to have avoided that. But it didn't shake my trust in God. I used to. I think probably 30 years ago, you bet, if I was going to have open heart surgery and I prayed for healing and I had friends agree with me in prayer for healing, that should work. Now, God didn't do that, so now I've got to go through healing. I'm going to ask Him, you know, guide the surgeons, help me through that. But I'm still going to be really disappointed that He didn't do it the way I was told He would if I believed enough. So then,
right.
Then I've got to either deal with I didn't believe enough, or He's a liar, or as someone who wrote in even on this podcast, I think, even doubting God's existence anymore, because I have prayed and I've asked Him to do these things, and He hasn't. There's been no reflection of His love in my life, and I kind of begin to thinking He's like Santa Claus. It just, you know, my parents lied to me about this and told me there was this great benevolent God up there, but He's done nothing in the 40 years, 50 years of my life to make anything known to me. What do you say to people like that? Do you talk to any that get that place?
Oh yeah, all the time. It's so sad, because what happens is, this is the way they've been taught. And to me, Christianity is an idea, it's a reality, it's a concept that we have to spend the rest of our lives on learning what we've learned. And that's what Jesus did. He said, you know, you have heard of old, but I say unto you, where we can get out and just see God from a whole different point of view, which is so, so difficult. We quote the verses, for example, that you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free. Well, what does that mean? Well, that I learn all the doctrines of my specific denomination. When in reality, truth is a person. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And somehow we in our Western culture just have to look at things from a point of view that's just technical. I remember when I was in the pastorate, I went to one of our pastoral conferences, and for a whole week, from Monday to Friday morning, we spent listening to paper after paper as to how long was a day, the first day, the second day, the third day, when in reality, what Genesis is teaching us is, guys, we have a wonderful God who created the world, who provides for us, who loves us beyond anything we can ever hope or believe, and that's it. Because in our Western mind, we look at the technical idea of how long is the yom, or a day in Hebrew. Where in reality, when the Hebrew mind wrote all of these things down in the Septuagint and in the Hebrew language and so forth, these words in the Bible are like a train. We don't concentrate on the train. We concentrate on what the train is carrying. And I think so often, you know, in our teaching, we just get to the point, if you know these four spiritual laws or seven spiritual laws or 10 spiritual laws, that's it. And we use language that nobody understands. You know, are you a sinner? Hmm. Well, what does that mean? You know, and somehow, if we could get beyond all of this, all of the words, and get into the concepts and get into really, who is God, and what is God like, and what does God say to me? He wants a relationship with me? Whoa, 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 what does that mean, and so forth. And if we could just, you know, to me, you end up with all that you were talking about, this anger and hostility, and, you know. I remember one of the lectures I went to, and when I was a hospice chaplain, where the speaker pointed out that what we really want to do to help the dying is to make sure that they can die a good death. Hmm. And that means that they understand forgiveness of others, forgiveness of God, and the hardest person to forgive yourself. And that you say, and then you ask others to forgive you as well. And then you say to them, you know, I love you. Thank you so much for who you are in our relationship, and goodbye. And if we could just apply those principles, even not necessarily when we're dying, but on an everyday level, to understand the forgiveness of others, to forgive others and forgive ourselves, so we don't live out our lives in shame and fear and worry.
Wouldn't that be awesome? So, and I, if we could just kind of lean into that space, and if people were helping us learn how to do that, and we'd be less focused on, you know, God, prove yourself to me, or try and meet the expectations I have of you, or whatever. I know when I talk to people who feel like, man, God's never made himself known to me, my first thought, and I may have to find a way to say it inside their pain that maybe they can hear it, but to me, you got to be looking in the wrong places, because my God doesn't abandon people. He is there with you, and you may not see in him because of whatever else you're looking for, but if I were you, I would be looking not to be angry at God or even push away any belief that God exists. I would say, well, maybe I'm looking in the wrong place. Where can I look to help find this same reality? And this, when you talk this way, Dave, this is when I wish people really knew you, because I think people on the other side of this microphone somewhere listening to us are going to say, well, that's easy to say if your life's all gone well and life's been easy. I've known you for a good number of years, man. I've watched you go through lots of stuff, betrayal, pain, loss of two children. Two of your four children have passed away. You've dealt with some physical diseases that are just horrendous. And I love how you keep talking about this refuge in God. And if people knew, this isn't coming from somebody whose life was easy and full of you know, great blessings, and everything went really well. And yet when I always talk to you, the amount of gratefulness in your heart, because there have also been incredibly wonderful things God's done in you, through you, for you, your life. And you haven't let the bad take away from the good.
Well, thank you. Just to go a step further, I see so many people go through life with a grudge toward God, a grudge toward family relationships. you know, and it's so sad. Sisters don't talk to sisters, brothers don't talk to brothers, parents don't talk to children. And it just grieves you. I remember preaching a funeral service, and I knew there were a lot of family members there who didn't even talk to one another. And in the service, I said that, you know, at the death of a loved one, it reminds us of who we are, who God is, and the whole concept of love. And then I deliberately talked about the whole concept of that as God reconciles us to him and we reconcile ourselves to God, we also reconcile to one another. And I didn't really know what to expect, but after that I closed the service and the family just started to weep and just love and hug one another. And, you know, I just love to see that, and you do too in people, to get away from all the negative stuff in our lives.
I just wonder if that's always possible. Is it? I mean, do we have at times people in our lives that are so abusive that, you know, you can forgive them and love them, but to continue to put yourself near them when they're hurtful and destructive? So, I mean, I love what you're saying. I love when that works out. And I've had relationships in my life that went bad for a long time and came back to healing. And it's just one of the best things in the world. But there, the healing of a relationship takes two people, right?
Oh, right. Yeah.
And sometimes there are just people that you have to put some distance. I mean, I get that email all the time. Someone's been abusive or particularly religiously abusive, and you try and be with your family and they just lord over you or, you know, condemn you or shame you. And there are times people need a safe distance from their relatives, but or friends. But I think always keep your heart. That's what I try to do. Always keep my heart open for reconciliation. Hopefully the day will come when we can find our way past. And if I've caused the hurt, I don't mind going to some man, I'm really sorry, I was an idiot. But when someone else is a source of that pain to me and they're not looking to change that, or every time you're with them, they want to bash on you again, then you know what? I'm not necessarily going to keep going down that road.
No, that's true. And I think we learned that from Jesus. You know, he didn't allow that to continue.
Yeah, no, he didn't. Anything else, Dave, from our time? Man, we covered a lot of stuff that people had written to us about, and I hope it's helpful for people. That little chart we had that I'll also put at the top of this one just so people can see it again, the idea of finding our sense of peace and security and love and life in him. And then I think if that first thing talks about that feels threatened, somehow my identity feels threatened or my security feels threatened. And then we start down that bad road. If we could recognize, and I think I'm learning to do this. I recognize when I feel threatened now. I realize when something seems to threaten and I'll go, hold it a minute. Is this really that? Is this really going to take me down that road? And be able to just lean back into Christ in the first stage is so much easier than 10 steps down the road, right? And if we can be more aware, I often talk to people about finding our way to freedom is mostly, it's not overnight, I just realized something and now I live differently, or I had a spiritual experience, now I never do that again. I think it's our getting lost in the lies of darkness becomes less frequent, less often, less intense as he becomes more real. And so we have more time, more freedom, more joy in learning to live in him. But they're always, the enemy's always, life is always wanting to sidetrack us from that. It's always wanting to threaten us, always wanting to make us feel at risk, so that we'll kind of lose our sense of God as our refuge and then try to find it somewhere else, so that we'll end up kind of broken again. And the enemy just seems to love to do that to us.
Sure does.
Hey, thanks for spending some time with me again, Dave. I always appreciate it. I miss you so much, man. You live so far away. I wish we were closer so we could hang out every week.
I do too, and may you and your family have a great summer.
Hey, we're working on that. We haven't got to the vacation part yet. It's been kind of hectic up till now, but later in the month we will. So hope you guys have it too.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.